Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back one of our great guest co-hosts, Laurel Sisler. Welcome back to Your Health, Laurel.
Thanks for having me back.
It's always exciting to have your perspectives here. And we've really got a really great show today. We're going to hear from a recent interview that Dr. Jonathan Fricke and I had with Dr. Lisa Coonan, Deputy Director of the Center for Disease Control's Influenza Coordination Unit. And she's also an adjunct professor in the UNC Gilling School of Public Health about fighting future flu outbreaks.
Yeah, and flu season is coming around again.
Yeah, it seems like it'll be here before we know it. In some parts of the world, it's right now. But speaking of right now, we have some research that matters. And let's dive right into our very first one, which is about doctors only allowing patients to speak for 11 seconds before interrupting. Does that ever happen to you when you go see a doctor?
It does, yep.
How does that seem to happen?
I'm not certain. I know that in my own clinical interactions with patients, it happens without even realizing it, even though I'm trained to listen to patients. It's just easy to find yourself cutting people off to either to move things along or to get the answers that you want.
This was actually research that was in the Journal of General Internal Medicine, and they did 112 recorded meetings between doctors and patients at general practices in Minnesota and Wisconsin, including the Mayo Clinic. And I've seen research like this before showing similar things, that doctors cut off patients quickly at the beginning of a visit. What I've never really seen, and I didn't see it in this particular one either, is what about experienced doctors who know their patients? Because they almost always get really great satisfaction scores from their patients. So is it the cutting off of the patient that matters, or is it a doctor who really has a relationship with the patient? I mean, how often do we cut off our spouses and our partners when we're talking in their relationship? Not that that's a good thing.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. The study found that 67% of patients were interrupted after responding, and only 36% of doctors even asked the type of questions that invite a patient to respond.
Yeah, and as expected, specialist physicians allow less time than primary care doctors. The reason they thought was that the specialist physicians knew why the patient was coming in, but the primary care doctors oftentimes do know that as well. It's written by the nurse frequently. You know, it's interesting. Sometimes I'll go into an exam room and I'll say, you know, what brings you in today? Or if I know the patient, I'll say, it's really great to see you again. And, you know, how are you doing? And that'll usually generate something. On the other hand, if it's a patient I may not know, I may say the same thing, but I may say, you know, my nurse indicated there's three or four things that you came in today. Can you tell me about those? But they can't tell you about them in 11 seconds.
Right. They wouldn't get very far at all.
Yeah. They say that the patient visits last longer when patients are allowed to explain their reason for visiting at the start of the conversation. I've actually heard that that may be more efficient because it allows you to get the information you need quicker than you cutting them off and having to go back and get it. I think the big thing is if a doctor is cutting you off early, maybe say, excuse me, could I finish? There's a few more things I want to say. There may be other ways of saying that, but you got to be able to tell why you're there.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the next research that matters, and it's about diabetes and cancer. I know through your work, Laurel, directing a large weight management program at the University of North Carolina, you see a lot of patients with diabetes coming in trying to lose weight. Do you talk about cancer? Has that been part of the conversation?
It's sometimes a direct thing that people are asking me about, whether it's somebody who has a history of breast cancer or a history of endometrial cancer. So it's on people's minds and they're asking me about it. I don't bring it up with every single person, but it's certainly an important thing to think about, knowing that having excess weight or having diabetes increases somebody's chance of getting cancer later on. And this study seems to confirm that that's the case.
And this was a research that was published in the journal Diabetologia. That's a mouthful, a lot of syllables there. But it's the Journal of the European Association for the Study of Diabetes. And looking at kind of a global review of what we know, 20 million people that diabetes can raise the risk of developing a cancer, both for men and for women, not uniformly across all cancers. And, the mechanism is still unseen, but it's certainly concerning. And I think you would say, well, is it related to obesity? I'd want to know, did they control for people who smoke, known causes of cancer? But it may be an independent, it may cause DNA damage. We don't know.
Yeah, that was my big question. And they're saying that the mechanism may be that elevated blood sugars cause that DNA damage. So not certain about that. There's still some unanswered questions.
Yeah, I think the bottom line is if you have diabetes or you have a loved one have diabetes and you are overweight or smoke, you got to change the risk factors. You got to do what you can. You got to lose the weight. That will cut down on the obesity, lower that risk. It may quit smoking, lower that risk. And then if you get your blood sugar under control or you lose weight and you don't need to take medicine for your diabetes, you probably have got the trifecta, the perfect ability to lower your risk of cancer. I'm excited by that.
Yeah, me too.
Let's talk about our very next research that matters. And this is a relationship between cancer, in this case, colon cancer, and soft drinks, low or no calorie soft drinks. This wasn't what I expected.
Me neither. There's certainly a lot of chatter about diet beverages leading to a slightly increased risk of cancer. And this study found actually the opposite. They looked at people who have a history of colon cancer and then looked at those who drank diet beverages versus, regular sodas or non-diet beverages, and actually found that the diet beverages was somewhat protective or reduced their chance of colon cancer recurrence, which, yeah, was not what I expected.
It was in the journal PLOS One, PLOS One, and they were talking about how these really artificially sweetened drinks, these diet drinks, could help avoid colon cancer recurrence. Patients who've been treated for advanced colon cancer. Over 1,000 patients, they were part of a large study for a different purpose, but they did a subgroup analysis here, and they were drinking these beverages, they had a 46% improvement in the risk of cancer recurrence or death compared to those who didn't drink them. This would not be necessarily a reason to go, because this was an association. They didn't do this as a cause and effect, a randomized controlled trial. This would not be the sort of study we would say, go out and recommend people to drink sugar sweetened or low or no calorie soft drinks if you have advanced colon cancer, would it?
No.
I don't think so.
It certainly would maybe ease the guilt in some of my patients' minds who are already hooked on diet drinks and perhaps.
And if they were drinking sweetened drinks and they wanted to go to non-sweetened drinks, you could say, well, there could be an association. It probably wouldn't hurt them in terms of their colon cancer recurrence.
But yeah, that's how I talk about them, as regular sodas and things like that in a high-risk category and diet sodas in a medium risk. But not low risk.
I liked other studies from this clinical trial has shown that those who drink coffee have a reduced risk of cancer and those who eat tree nuts. So I thought coffee, tree nuts, and low sugar beverages. It sounds great.
The trifecta.
The trifecta again. Let's talk about our last research that matters. And this is really concerning. And this is drinking habits among young people. And I know we've talked several times in the last year about data that suggests that alcohol use is really on an increase among those younger adults. And this really directly addresses it in ways that are really, I think, disturbing.
Yeah, I agree. This is a Center for Disease Control study published in BMJ recently, looking specifically at liver cancer death rates, and that there's been a big increase over the last 20 years or so, a 65% increase, rather, in people dying of cirrhosis, and then a doubling of people dying of liver cancer over that 20-year time period.
And the younger Americans saw the largest increase in the cirrhosis, the scarring of the liver, predominantly due from drinking. And, I think this really is a wake-up call. We've had the wake-up call on opioids, and really Americans and families are taking it seriously. This is a wake-up call. It's not reached the proportion that people are talking about it, but it really is that kind of seriousness that we have to have with our young adults about the real dangers of excessive alcohol use.
Yeah, and perhaps people think about your typical person with alcohol issues as somebody who comes home and drinks every single night. But this, they're talking specifically about binge drinking, which is not every night, but it is in high quantities. And so it may not look exactly like what you're thinking about, but it's still a problem.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to hear a real recent interview we had with Dr. Lisa Coonan, Deputy Director of the CDC's Influenza Coordination Unit and Adjunct Assistant Professor in the UNC Gillings School of Public Health, about fighting future flu outbreaks. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisler. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jonathan Fricke. Today on Conversations, Jonathan, we're talking with Dr. Lisa Coonan, Deputy Director of the Center for Disease Control's Influenza Coordination Unit and Adjunct Assistant Professor in the University of North Carolina's Gillings School of Public Health, about fighting future flu outbreaks. Welcome, Dr. Coonan.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You've got such an interesting history and storied experiences. You've traveled around the world with the CDC. How did you get interested in healthcare and healing and public health?
Oh, my gosh. Well, it goes way back. When I was a teenager, I was a volunteer in a local hospital and just got fascinated with medicine, helping people most of all, and also solving the mystery of what was going on with them and how to make them better. I chose a path of becoming a nurse and then a nurse practitioner. When I first started my graduate program at Emory to become a nurse practitioner, I was offered the opportunity to also enroll in the School of Public Health. And frankly, at the time, I didn't understand what public health was very much and why I would need or want a degree in public health. But I quickly found that it was appealing to me, and so I accepted the offer. And then in my dual degree program, I became a nurse practitioner and also an epidemiologist. And from that sort of accidental pathway, I was recruited to work at CDC after being in the medical field, in the clinical field for about 10 years. So I've been at CDC for 30 years now.
Wow. And we're going to get into some of the things that you studied, and particularly how you came to your leadership role within influenza.
So again, more of an accidental path. I have had many leadership roles in nursing and nursing faculty and as a nurse practitioner leading clinical teams. When I came to CDC, I was recruited to be the chief of reproductive health surveillance. And over time, several health problems arose that we recognize as being significant health problems in the U.S. And one was really trying to think about how you change the kind of prevention care that's offered to people who have health insurance. And we learned so much by talking with businesses and insurers and third-party coverage. And so I became the chief for private sector partnerships. So one day the CDC director came and told us that there had been a new influenza virus found in Asia that was brand new, never seen before, causing quite a lot of severe illness in the few people it did infect. And businesses and private sector organizations were concerned about this because they were located in all parts of the world. And they really needed some guidance and help to protect their workforce and to plan for a flu pandemic. So I got swept into that project. I led that project. And in 2005, we produced a business checklist for pandemic influenza. Within 4 weeks after producing that checklist, I got a call from the White House. They were putting together the National Pandemic Influenza Implementation Plan and needed some consultation on the chapter for private industry and asked me to join the writing team. So one thing just led to another.
So I'm curious, you know, when most people think about what epidemiologists do, I think a lot of people recently first comes to mind is Ebola or other very exotic things to chase. Do you find being an influenza sleuth to be just as exciting and challenging, or what are the differences between that and some of these emerging viruses in your day-to-day work?
Oh, that's a great question, and I'm going to answer it in a couple of ways. First of all, you know, you could go a lifetime as a clinical practitioner or epidemiologist and see maybe one or two exotic diseases arise at the level of an outbreak that could cause great concern. But flu happens every year. And although people don't recognize it, flu is a very serious illness for a lot of people. Thousands of people are hospitalized each year with influenza, and many people die from it. The thing that I've learned about flu is you cannot predict it. It is totally unpredictable. Flu changes. It changes its form from one family of flu viruses to another. It is different every year, and that's why we have to make a new flu vaccine every year to adapt to the changing virus of flu. And then once in a while, a virus will shift, meaning that we'll have a significant change, and usually from an animal species, will jump to become a human disease. That's what causes a pandemic. At CDC, we say it's not if a pandemic will happen, but when, and we don't know when, because flu is so unpredictable.
We know it's been 100 years since the major flu pandemic, and very few people would have been alive during that time. Help us understand what that means and why you spend a lot of time trying to prevent or respond when that occurs again.
Well, it may have been 100 years since there was the severe pandemic of 1918. But we have had four pandemics, including that one, in the last 100 years. In 1957, there was a pandemic that arose in East Asia. It triggered a pandemic all over the world, and it caused over 100,000 deaths in the U.S. alone and over 1 million deaths worldwide. In 1968, a slightly milder pandemic arose, and that pandemic started in about September of 1968. Over 1 million people worldwide died from that, and again, about 100,000 in the U.S., and it really affected people who were older than 65. And then in 2009, in very recent memory, in the spring of 2009, and then again in the fall, a new pandemic virus, which was H1N1, arose. It affected millions of people all over the world, even though the death rate in the U.S. was much lower than that of 57 and 68. It caused quite a number of people who were sick. Over about 61 million people were sick. 750,000 of people were affected by having someone in their family or in their workplace sick, and about 275,000 hospitalizations. So there have been pandemics all throughout the last 100 years of varying severity and varying impact.
Dr. Koonin, I'm wondering if you have any numbers so far or predictions on what the flu season looks like for this coming year.
Well, like I said, flu is unpredictable, and a wise person would never try to make a prediction. So there's two types of influenza that circulates, influenza A, and those are usually called H1N1 and H3N2. Those are two different families of influenza A viruses, and they circulate every year, and then influenza Bs. So what we do at CDC is we monitor flu viruses all over the world. We're particularly looking at the southern hemisphere when it's our summer because they're having winter down there, and that's their flu season. And then twice a year, CDC scientists and experts from all over the world come together, bring their surveillance data to the table, talk about the circulating strains, and make decisions about what ingredients will be in next season's vaccine. And so The Southern Hemisphere's process starts in September, and the Northern Hemisphere process is in February. So we're monitoring these viruses all over the world. And again, it's unpredictable.
When we return, we're going to continue talking to Dr. Lisa Coonan, Deputy Director of the CDC's Influenza Coordination Unit and Adjunct Assistant Professor in UNC's Gilling School of Public Health, about fighting future flu outbreaks. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Gulls and Dr. Jonathan Fricke. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jonathan Fricke. We've been talking with Dr. Lisa Coonan, Deputy Director of the CDC's Influenza Coordination Unit and Adjunct Assistant Professor in the University of North Carolina's Gilling School of Public Health, about fighting future flu outbreaks. And Dr. Coonan, right before the break, I think you were talking about the unpredictability as the only thing that perhaps is predictable. And that kind of reminds me of this last flu season, in which, to me, it was the worst in perhaps 20 plus years that I've been practicing, that it started much earlier and it kind of continued. Yes, there were peaks and valleys, but it just seemed like, wow, this was different. What did you learn from this past season from your perspective, looking at this as a national issue?
Well, you're right. It was quite a robust flu season. We had more hospitalizations of elderly people than we've ever seen before, and more deaths, of pediatric deaths, than we've seen for any other year other than the year of the 2009 pandemic. So it was a very aggressive virus. It did last a long time in communities, and it really affected a lot of people. It was unfortunate that some people were not vaccinated, and those people, for a large part, did suffer from getting disease. So even though our vaccines aren't perfect, they reduce the risk of flu illness by between 40 and 60%. So although we did have a somewhat effective vaccine out there, some people didn't get it, and some of those people really did suffer with the flu.
You bring up an important point, and a point that a lot of people use as a reason not to get the flu vaccine is that the effectiveness isn't perfect. Can you talk a little bit more about why it's important to have a flu vaccine?
Well, the flu vaccine can keep you from getting sick with the flu. It can reduce the risk of hospitalization from flu, especially among children and older adults. And it's a real important preventive tool for people who have chronic underlying health conditions like heart disease or diabetes. Flu vaccination has been associated with a lower rate of heart events, like a heart attack, for people that have underlying heart disease. It also has been associated with reduced hospitalizations among people who have diabetes or chronic lung disease. Vaccination also can protect women during and shortly after pregnancy. So getting vaccinated is important for a pregnant woman because it not only protects her, but also protects the baby after birth. So even though it's imperfect, it does have some protective effects.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of the larger public health tools at your disposal to help manage, prevent. And I'm thinking about some of the research I saw, I think, last year that, you know, when you have this flu that's pandemic in a community, you know, you have to do some things that you might not normally do, like closing schools or telling people not to go into the doctor's office, things like that. How do you make those decisions? Who makes those decisions?
Well, these are really important subjects. So flu is transmitted from person to person by coughing or sneezing, and then a person who's standing close by can breathe those germs into their respiratory tract, become ill. Also, people who touch a surface that's been recently coughed or sneezed or touched can also transfer those germs to their eyes, nose, or mouth. So the cardinal thing is that during a flu pandemic, which is a brand new flu that usually causes more serious illness than seasonal flu, is keeping sick people and well people apart in space. And this is called social distancing. Now, you mentioned school closure. Children are very vulnerable to getting sick with the flu, but they're also really good spreaders of the flu. So during a severe pandemic, one where there's a lot of people becoming ill and a lot of people dying, unfortunately, we may have to take measures that we wouldn't take every day. One of those might be closing schools. We would definitely recommend that sick people stay home, don't go to work, or in the community, because keeping people apart, sick people and well people apart, will help slow down the transmission of the flu.
That would include doctors, right?
You know,
not going into work.
All of us in the medical profession always feel that we have to be rugged and we have to go to work no matter what. But the wise thing to do for everyone, no matter what their job is if they're sick with a fever and a respiratory infection, to stay home until that fever subsides for 24 hours, just so they won't get other people sick. You also asked about how we make those decisions. And I will tell you that the decisions are made very carefully. Just like in medicine, there's a risk-benefit decision about giving a patient a drug or a certain therapy. There's a careful analysis of the risk and the benefits of recommending something like school closure.
I'm curious if you could enlighten me to this seasonal variation that happens. I have a few ideas in my mind or ways that I've always explained it, just that's what happens is that people get sick in the winter. But do we know a reason why flu tends to be more common in the winter?
Well, there's a lot of hypotheses. People are more indoors than outdoors. They may be more crowded together. The humidity in those indoor spaces may be lower than usual. There may be a number of environmental things. But when we talk about a disease, it's always characteristics of the disease itself, the characteristics of the person, whether they're weak or strong in their immune system, whether they're protected by vaccine or not, and also the characteristics of the environment that they're in.
As we think about in your future world, Dr. Koonin, of 20 years from now, where do you think we'll be? What's the future hold? What do we need to do to get to that future?
Well, unfortunately, I think there will still be flu, but I do think we will have a lot of tools to deal with it. We may be able to more quickly get medicines to people through the kind of delivery methods that we're starting to see emerge now. People may be using testing kits that they have at home, so as soon as they feel bad, they can test themselves and let their provider know that they're testing positive for flu and rapidly start medicine so they can get better quickly. Maybe vaccines will be administered in a different way, maybe not only through a shot, but maybe through patches on the skin or some other way. And I'm sure we're going to have more effective vaccines. A tremendous amount of focus and study is focusing on that. In fact, there's a very large initiative right now to develop a universal flu vaccine. And what that means is a flu vaccine that will fight any flu, that we don't have to have a flu shot every single year. So I'm hoping in 20 years we'll have all of those things and more.
I think many of our listeners would also be on board with one single flu shot.
I think so, too. And that is the moonshot, but work is underway with the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, leading that work, and a number of my colleagues participating in it.
What is the Flu on Call project?
Flu on Call. So during a flu pandemic, when a lot of people are getting sick all at the same time, you can imagine how many people might be crowding into emergency rooms and clinics and doctor's offices. And if people are clogging the works, if you will, there may be delays in seeing a provider. Now, the one thing about flu for treatment is that we do have a medicine that are effective, but they have to be given very quickly after a person becomes sick, preferably within 48 hours after they become ill. If it's hard to get to see a provider, you won't be able to get that prescription, and then that medicine could be delayed, and then that would have a bad effect. So FluoCall is an effort to create a national telephone call line where people could call from anywhere in the United States, talk to professionals, medical professionals, and based on their symptoms and based on their medical history, get timely advice about where to go, what to do, and if they have an uncomplicated case of the flu, perhaps even get access to that medicine without having to see a provider face-to-face. We've been working on it for a number of years with our state and local health department partners and technology firms, and we think that this could be a way that we could help people improve access to medicine and reduce the surge on medical facilities during a pandemic.
From your mouth to God's ears.
Thank you so much for talking with us. We've been talking with Dr. Lisa Coonan. She's Deputy Director of the CDC's Influenza Coordination Unit and an Adjunct Assistant Professor in UNC's Gillings School of Public Health. We've been talking about fighting future flu outbreaks today.
Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
We really appreciate it.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health Radio with Dr. Jonathan Fricke and Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Laurel and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And Laurel, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
For the past year, every time I eat strawberries, my throat gets a little itchy. I don't get hives or anything else more serious, but I'm beginning to suspect that I might have a food allergy. My understanding is that my allergist tests for environmental allergies, but not food allergies. Who should I talk to about this?
Whew, that's tough, being allergic to strawberries or really any fruit. I would have a hard time with that.
Blueberries, strawberries, mangoes. Well, what's interesting is I wonder if this is a allergy to red berries, because you can sometimes have other sorts of, so raspberries, you know, things that would be red. What other red fruit do we have?
Cherries.
Cherries could possibly do it. So you'd want to kind of see here, but it does sound a little suspicious. I mean, you know, I would think anytime you start getting a tingling in your throat after not eating one of those little sparkly poply things that you could, used to, the candy
yes.
that used.
Yeah, what are
pop
they
rocks.
Called?
Yeah. You know, unless you're eating Pop Rocks, you know, I don't think it really counts. So I think you would want to see your pediatrician, your primary care physician, or an allergist to see. You know, a lot of times we want to find out, do you have allergies on top of this? Do you have asthma on top of this? Because those sort of things go together. People have asthma and allergies and are allergic to certain things. I don't know if anyone in your family's ever had allergies, Laurel.
I do have lots of family members with allergies, specifically to cats, which is a bummer because I love cats. But no, nobody with a red berry allergy, not to my knowledge, at least.
Yeah, the good news is that if you are allergic, it's, I think, easier to potentially avoid strawberries than it would be to avoid a lot of times nuts, which can be in so many different products. I don't know how many people like throw strawberries in with the peanut butter.
True.
Maybe the jelly.
Unless it's the mixed peanut butter and jelly.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
I've been overweight most of my adult life, and I'd like to consider getting some professional help to get on track. I've heard you guys talk a lot about weight management programs in the past, and I was curious if you know if my insurance might cover this kind of thing.
Laura, you probably deal with this daily, multiple times a day.
Yeah, it's a great question. My annoying response is it really depends on your health insurance, and I know that that's being on the receiving end of that fact is just not fun. So I would call your insurance and see what they offer. Ask specifically whether they cover medical nutritional therapy by a registered dietitian. That's a great question, very specific question to ask. And then, you know, other good places to go is your primary care office. I know at UNC Family Medicine, we have a comprehensive weight management program that's a very low cost to the patient. So that would be a good place to start.
How about apps? People can go online and use various apps. Some people use Weight Watchers. They have to pay for that. Yep. Really, anything that helps our patients, our colleagues, our friends, our family members get into some structure that helps them with goal setting, with caloric control, with really resetting their relationship with food in a wholesome, healthy way, thinking about fresh fruits, whole grains, less complex fatty foods perhaps, or less complex carbohydrates or less meat, some things that are generally healthier for most people.
Yeah. Yep. And you asked about apps too, in terms of free apps that are out there. MyFitnessPal and Lose It are both free apps that are really effective in terms of getting us to check in regularly about what it is we're eating. Even you could just go old school and write down in paper and pen what you're eating every day. And that in and of itself, you have to stop, reflect, and just be a little bit more mindful as you're going about your day.
What's our very next house call?
I'm considering doing genetic testing to see what my DNA says about my health. Do you think that those are accurate, and can that information be helpful?
Well, this is actually, I think, a very personal question for a lot of people. And I would say 10 years ago, we probably would have said, no, the state of the science hasn't gotten good enough to reliably tell you what you may have or may be susceptible to having, but it's gotten better. And I think a lot of people today are interested in finding that information. And I would say it's a good thing to know if you are okay with knowing it, right?
Yeah, that's always my thought is what do you really want to find out, and maybe think a little bit about what would be the best scenario and what would be the worst scenario. And if it is that worst scenario, going to see a specialist that can give you a little counseling, whether that's a genetic counselor or a doctor. You could find out some news that you don't want to hear.
Right. But on the other hand, if you are maybe putting off exercising and losing weight because you just think, I don't want to think about it, and then you find out you really are highly susceptible to coronary artery disease or certain types of cancer associated with those habits, maybe it motivates you in ways that other things don't motivate you. We don't want to see you get used in a way that would be detrimental, like for insurance purposes or other things. So I would say talk with your spouse, talk with your sister, your brother, whoever you are close with, and then maybe talk with your primary care provider and then make a decision. Can't hurt.
Sounds like a good plan.
Laura, what's our very last house call?
I'm a healthy 25-year-old woman, and I'm curious about what vitamins I need to be taking. Does a multivitamin cover it, or should I supplement with other ones?
This is a question I get a lot. I'm sure you do as well, Adam. The best way to get vitamins is from your diet. So thinking about getting a wide variety of colors of fruits and vegetables is one of the best ways that you can make sure you're getting all the vitamins you need. Another thing I would think about as a 25-year-old woman is if you're of childbearing age at all, you should be getting 400 micrograms of folic acid. So you can get that in a multivitamin, or you could get it in a prenatal vitamin. That's really the only thing that I know of that you need outside of regular nutrition.
Yeah, I had a patient recently, Laurel, who's taking cinnamon, ginkgo, vitamin E, vitamin D, calcium, a B12 supplement, and turmeric. Now, those aren't all vitamins, but it suggests that more patients rather than less patients are really interested and believe that vitamins and supplements improve their health.
Yeah.
The problem is that there isn't enough data that suggests which patients, if any, benefit from which drugs that they're taking. And that's the hard problem. So a lot of people are taking vitamin D, and you can get a vitamin D level. You can get most of your vitamin levels checked in blood tests. Whether they really help you, the Preventive Medicine Services Task Force really doesn't recommend vitamin supplementation for almost anyone who eats a healthy diet, other than, as you mentioned, folic acid for pregnancy. You know, obviously, if you have osteoporosis or thinning of the bones, if you have certain cancers, if you have a B12 deficiency, that's different. But if you're young and healthy, 25, you're probably better off just going on and eating and keeping good health habits.
Yep.
Well, that'll conclude the house calls for our show today. We want to thank all of our listeners for joining us. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you and your health. You can send any questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship. I want to thank my guest co-hosts Laurel Sisler and Jonathan Fricke for our interview with Dr. Koonin, and our guest today, Dr. Lisa Koonin. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health, on behalf of Your Health. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
I'm Laurel Sisler.
And we look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.